Good morning, and welcome to the Thursday, March 25th, 2021 meeting of the Education Finance Committee. Remote hearings are held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This rule has been posted online and is linked to in our public meeting notice on the House website. All remote hearings will be recorded and live streamed by House Public Information Services. Members have the contents of their virtual packets available to them, and for the public, these materials have been posted online. Members, if you're looking for all these items in one place, they're attached in the calendar event you have that Ms. Burt sent for today. To get on the list to be recognized by the chair, members using the Zoom interface have the ability to raise their hand via the app. Ms. Burt will place your name on the list to be recognized. Ms. Sunderland, would you please call the roll?
Chair Dabney.
Present.
Vice Chair Sandstead.
Present.
Representative Kreisha.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Damon.
Present.
Representative Drazkowski.
Present.
Representative Erickson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Jordan.
Present.
Representative Marquardt. Representative Marquardt. Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Richardson is excused, but she'll be joining us later. Oh, sorry, I didn't see you there. Representative Richardson has been marked as president. Representative Thompson.
Thompson, present.
Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Joachim. Representative Joachim. That is the roll, and we do have a quorum. Chair, you're muted.
There I go. Thank you. Good to get that out of the way early in the hearing. Representative Bennett, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes from the Wednesday, March 24th meeting? And if so, would you like to move approval of those minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I so move.
Thank you very much. Any discussion to the Bennett motion? Hearing none. All those in favor of the Bennett motion approving the minutes from Wednesday, March 24th, please signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Bennett. You can tell that this is the week before our Easter Passover break, members. We've got a number of bills on the agenda, and we'll be moving through them. The order of the bills is reflected on the agenda you received last night. We're taking up House File 1985 first, then followed by House Files 1464, 965, 1644, and then ending with House File 2357. It's our intention to lay these bills over for possible inclusion and wrap up at noon. First up, we have House File 1985. Representative Jordan, would you like to make a motion to move House File 1985 before the committee and to lay it over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. Members of the committee and members of the public were looking to lay this bill over by 10:50 a.m. Representative Jordan, before you introduce your bill, I understand you have an author's amendment you'd like to offer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members of the committee. And so before I talk broadly about House File 1985, I'd like to ask your indulgence to also make an oral amendment to my author's amendment and strike lines 3.19 to 3.21. After consulting with MDE, we both agree these lines are vague and unnecessary. Additionally, my DE amendment as amended adds two separate aid formulas, one to fill behind the lunch program and the other to fill in behind breakfast. This amendment also expands the options for counting students eligible for free and reduced price meals to determine compensatory revenue. And so I ask for your support to put House File 1985 in the shape I'd like it.
Representative Jordan, would you please restate your oral amendment to the DE1 amendment, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It would be to strike lines 3.19 to 3.21.
All right. You may incorporate that amendment into your DE1 amendment. With that, members, any discussion to the author's amendment to put the bill in the order the chief prefers? Seeing none, all in favor of the DE1 amendment with the incorporated change, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Jordan, to your bill as amended.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and fellow members of the committee. We all know that Minnesota is a state that values education and wants to see every child succeed, but unfortunately we fall short in creating equal opportunities for all students without exception. And in a state with an agricultural tradition as rich as ours, it's particularly unacceptable that 1 in 6 Minnesota students are going hungry. The legislature has already taken steps to ban school lunch shaming, and I'm so grateful to both DFL and Republican leaders who have made ending this a priority. House File 1985, as amended, would enroll more schools in the community eligibility program, which would provide meals for all students at eligible schools. CEP is a federal program that provides universal, no-cost meals at schools in high-poverty neighborhoods where many students come from families eligible for SNAP and other nutrition assistance. Students and their families do not need to apply like they do with free and reduced-price lunch programs. Minnesota currently ranks 47th in the nation for schools enrolled in CEP. This bill is an opportunity for all of us, Democrats, Republicans, and Independents representing urban, rural, and suburban districts to come together to feed children. And you can see that diversity reflected in both House and Senate authors. It's truly such an honor to be with advocates that you're about to hear from who cross these barriers to end childhood hunger. House File 1985, as amended, is a bill to close the opportunity gaps between white students and students of color. And this is a bill to improve student mental health. And finally, this is a bill to grow happy and healthy families across Minnesota. With that, Chair Dabney, I'd like to ask our testifiers to speak to why including House File 1985 in our omnibus is so critical. And I also have Leah Gardner with me from Hunger Solutions, and we would be happy to answer members of the committee may have. Thank you.
So, Representative Jordan, I don't have Ms. Gardner on my list of testifiers. Would you like her to testify, or is she
phone-a-friend? She's a phone-a-friend.
Okay. Thank you very much. First on my list is Louise Iverson with the General Mills Foundation. Ms. Iverson, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Louise Iverson, and I'm a senior program manager on General Mills' Global Social Impact Team. But General Mills is committed to making food the world loves, and core to that commitment is our ambition to help end childhood hunger. We are so proud to call Minnesota home to our world headquarters, but we are dismayed that 1 in 6 children in Minnesota currently experience hunger. We know that school meals are a powerful pathway for reducing childhood hunger, and that's why we support this legislation. And as a member of the Minnesota Business Coalition for Racial Equity, we are among a broad, growing number of Minnesota businesses who support this legislation because it will help address our state's profound and unacceptable racial disparities in child hunger, health, and educational outcomes. Investing in the future of our state's young people isn't just the right thing to do. It also makes good business sense. Thank you for this opportunity to share my testimony.
Thank you very much, Ms. Iverson. Next on my list is Carl Childs, a youth advocate with Appetite for Change. Mr. Childs, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carl Childs. I'm a youth leader at Appetite for Change. I go to North Community High School. I'm a senior. I just wanted to talk to you guys about why we should pass this bill. I think we should pass it because growing up in school, my whole life I had free reduced lunch, but a lot of my friends didn't. So, like, and I know they didn't have food at home, so they would have to come to school. So if they wasn't able to pay for their school lunch, they'd have to get, like, cold lunches or they won't eat. They have to miss some days because they have to, you know, find ways to eat other than school. And I just feel like that's wrong, wasting opportunity for people my age and people our future to thrive and do better in life. So if we have free lunches, we won't have to worry about eating. We can focus on school and we can thrive better in the classrooms. Thank you for your time. Thank you for listening to my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Childs. Next and last on my list is Claire Chase, a parent with students in the Castlake Venus Schools. Ms. Chase, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Claire Chase, and I live in Bena, Minnesota. I have five children, four of which attend the Castlake Venus School District, and I'm testifying in support of House Bill 1985, which would allow more schools to provide breakfast and lunch to all students. As a parent of Castlake Venus School District, I am so grateful that my kids and their peers don't need to worry about whether or not they can access school meals. Sometimes these are the only meals that these children are getting. Thanks to the CEP, all kids in our school are eligible for free breakfast and lunch, and they even offer a program for kids in after-school activities to have dinner at the schools. And that's huge for so many of these families. This program has allowed all kids consistent access to healthy meals throughout the years without stigma and with huge benefits to the community. In fact, this is something that even I benefited from when I was a child at the same school district. And I can tell you that while both my parents were employed and providing for my siblings, we still struggled. And this was a huge stress relief that was lifted from my parents during my youth. And now it has allowed our school district to act quickly to meet the needs of all families during COVID. During this past year, our school district was able to provide two meals and a snack to all families in the school district 5 days out of the week that chose to opt in. And for the duration of the entire time that our district was in distant learning, they delivered the meals to our communities, which is a huge geographical area. And they made sure that families were fed and those families didn't have to worry if they were eligible or not when they picked up extra shifts or got new jobs to survive during the pandemic. And just from my professional work, I can tell you that food insecurity is a very real issue in our community and across the whole state. And unfortunately, it was an issue before COVID and will be long afterwards. In order for schools and students to be successful, we must do all that we can to make sure no child is going without their nutritional needs being met. So thank you for your time considering this important bill.
Thank you, Ms. Chase. Members, when this hearing was posted, the public was provided with instructions on how to sign up to testify during the public portion of this bill hearing. Given our busy agenda, we're only able to hear a limited amount of public testimony on our bills today. However, we still wanted to save room for members of the public who reached out to us. On my list for this bill, I have Mr. Brenton Lexfold. Mr. Lexfold, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brenton Lexfold, and I'm the Director of Student Nutrition Services and Registered Dietitian for the Red Wing Public Schools in Red Wing, Minnesota. In addition, I'm also the Public Policy and Legislative Chair for the Minnesota School Nutrition Association, representing over 3,000 school nutrition professionals within our great state. Red Wing has been serving up meals and children in schools and within the Red Wing community during the onset of the COVID pandemic. Our meal program has seen steadily meal counts and amazing community support, which has helped keep our program afloat during these unprecedented times. Many school nutrition programs in the state are struggling due to low community participation, rising costs of products, in a market of uncertainty. As the PPL chair and a registered dietitian, I support any bill that may help bridge the food insecurity children in our communities are facing. With childhood nutrition being a focus for Secretary Vilsack, I truly believe the time has come to foster robust conversations on how we can ensure our children have access to free meals for all students at no charge. State funding to cover the gap for CEP is one way to make this work for some schools and students. But we want the committee to be aware that MSNA is continually working with our national partner, SNA, in asking Congress to make this happen. Furthermore, we heard a report last December from our national lobbyists that the Congressional Budget Office had forecasted the 10-year cost to provide all students free lunch and breakfast nationwide at $40 billion for the decade, or $4 billion per year. The federal waivers creating free meals from last year and now through the summer and perhaps in the fall have helped many families. And we believe the time has come for Congress to permanently expand the national school lunch and breakfast programs to offer students meals at no charge as an integral part of the educational experience. In conclusion, ensuring our children have access to nutritious meals on a daily basis is important. It is the single most imperative step we can do to ensure the future of this great nation. Thank you for your time and allowing me to speak on behalf of the passionate school nutrition professionals in the great state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Lexfold. Questions from members. Representative Erickson, I see you have your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a question for the author. I'm looking at the delete all, and this might not be different from the original bill, but only certain schools will qualify. Is that correct, Representative Jordan?
Representative Jordan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, that is correct.
So what does the Title VII of the federal regulation, Section 245.9, say about qualifying? Because I suspect that we're going to have a lot of schools that don't qualify.
Representative Jordan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Erickson. We do have a number of schools that don't qualify. The bill's intent is to make this school, to have this to the schools that will qualify under this program would be schools that are eligible for full reimbursement under the federal CEP program.
Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Jordan, there is, though, a punishment of a type if they're not compliant. Is that correct?
Representative Jordan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erickson, which part are you looking at?
Subdivision 5, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson, Subdivision 5. Can you give a line and page on that,
please? Yeah, 4.1 through 4.6.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I have too many tabs open. Can you repeat the initial question?
Yeah.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Jordan, on lines 4.1 through 4.6 under reporting obligations for non-compliant full reimbursement qualifying schools. So a school that fails to comply with sub 4, which is the subdivision before, must respond to a notification of non-compliance from the department. Response must include a report available to the public on any obstacles to participation that contributed to the non-compliance. I'm just puzzled by this particular provision.
Representative Jordan?
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really understand your question, but maybe Ms. Gardner could take a stab at it.
Oh, that'd be great. Thank you.
Ms. Gardner, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. If you can help us understand this issue, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Leah Gardner. I'm with Hunger Solutions Minnesota. And the intent of that section is to better understand if a school is fully eligible and not participating in the community eligibility provision, what barriers there might be. So it's simply to allow for more transparency and understanding what more we might be able to do to help a school that's fully eligible and yet not participating in the provision.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's rather punitive, but so we'll proceed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Thompson, I see you have your hands up.
Chair, thank you. And to the author of this bill, I just wanted to say thank you. I do know for a fact the reason I'm here and a part of this body is because of my good friend Philando Castile, who I watched actually go in his pocket. You know, Philando was a school lunch supervisor. And for children who didn't have $1.40 in their lunch account, they were over, he would put it in the cash register for them. He also knew their dietary needs, their allergies. He would tell kids, like, listen, put that milk back, you're lactose intolerant. You can't have those peanuts. Behind Philando was their list and their faces, but he weeded those kids out, knowing their food allergies by heart. Here we are now. We used to come to this body and ask to fully fund kids' lunches because they would be a lunch shame, and we were told that we didn't have the money. And then COVID hit, and now we're delivering the food with school buses. So I know we can do this. Also, the Philando Castile Relief Foundation travels this state right now as we speak, paying off student lunch debt to the tune of $20,000, $10,000, $5,000, just in honor of my good friend Philando Castile. I do know that these kids are our future, all children. And the least we can do for them is provide a hot lunch and a cold breakfast. I know these kids are our future. And there's data that shows when a kid eats a healthy breakfast and lunch, they kind of learn better. They do learn better. I can remember not having money in my school account, and they would give us a cheese sandwich chair and an applesauce. Even though we had lunch to eat, the kids knew that we were poor. And kids are very mean to, like, I don't know if you guys know that, they're very mean to us. I just wanted to share that with you guys and say thank you, because this is a continuation of the legacy of my good friend Philando Castile and the work that the Philando Castile Relief Foundation is doing to this day to eliminate student hunger. Thank you so much, guys. This means so much to me.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then to the author, I'm just curious on a couple little things. I love the intent of the bill. I know the CEP program's been around for quite a while. A lot of schools do it voluntary. So my first question is, we're changing it from a voluntary to a mandatory. Is that correct?
Representative Jordan, can you help us understand the intent of the bill, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Daniels, for the question. Right now, schools are not obligated to participate in CEP, and as a result, Minnesota schools are not taking this up. And the result of that is ultimately that children are going hungry at school. The intent of this bill is for children to be fed at school and to have more schools bring up the CEP program. We know that we've done a lot to make sure that we're providing students that fill out the free and reduced price lunch waiver, but there are a lot of students that are falling through the cracks that might not qualify for those subsidies but are still not being fed and are trying to learn on an empty stomach. You know, I think Representative Thompson maybe said it even better than I did, where he talked about the impact that our school nutrition staff and our the meals have on students and their outlook on life and their ability to learn. So that's the intent of this bill, is to make sure that more schools are participating so that they can feed children.
Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, I'm just wondering, in my school districts that I visited and talked to, they've already been doing this for quite a long time. And I'm just unfamiliar with the rest of the state. Do you have a list of the school districts that are not doing this? I mean, I'd be curious to see where that problem is and how big that problem is.
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Daniels, yes, we can provide that list. I can tell you that the problem is spread across the state, and there are many schools in every corner of the state that are not participating in CEP that would be eligible to provide free meals for every single child at their school that are not currently doing so. We'd be happy to get that to members.
Representative Daniels, any follow-up?
I'm just curious. I see Mr. Strom put his video on. Do you have any more information on that, Mr. Strom?
Mr. Strom, can you help us out?
Mr. Chair, members, we'll see what we can provide to you. There's two different things going on. There's the list of those that are fully funded currently where a site may not be participating. And then for those below essentially the 60% level, the funding is less than full funding for those districts. So we could use a free and reduced count from last fall to by site to look at that. We wouldn't be able to give you a fiscal estimate of that, but we could identify the sites that are greater than 40% and less than 60% eligible for free and reduced price meals. There may be other reasons the author wishes to address, or perhaps Ms. Gardner would address, about why qualifying schools that are fully funded currently don't participate in the program. And that's a list I don't have, is those that are that would be fully funded but choose not to participate.
Representative Daniels, any final comment?
Just that would be a nice list to have, just so we know how huge the problem is and what we need to do to fix it. So thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Daniels. Representative Jordan, any closing comments?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Daniels, we will get you a list of those schools. I do have that. But thank you, members of the committee, for hearing this bill. Again, I really want to emphasize that this bill is about feeding children. I think we have a lot of adult problems for why schools may or may not be able to do that, and that's our job in this committee to fix. And this is something that we can actually do to make a difference and feed all of our students. So thank you for your consideration today, and please let me know if you have further questions.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. With that, Representative Jordan renews her motion to lay over House File 1985 is amended for possible inclusion in a future omnibus. To the testifiers, thank you for joining us today. Next on our list is House File 1464. Representative Mueller, would you like to make a motion to move House File 1464 to be before the committee and to lay it over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill?
I would like to move that House File 1464 be moved in front of the committee for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Thank you very much. Representative, members of the committee and members of the public, we're looking to lay this bill over by 11:05. We'll see how we do on that. Representative Bliss, welcome to the committee. Good to have you joining us today. Would you please proceed in introducing your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My bill is HF 1464, and it provides some funding, $611,000 in fiscal year 22, to provide professional development for earth and space science teachers. And I do have a testifier here. Dana Smith is going to go into a little bit more as to why this funding is needed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Smith, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Dana Smith, and I am a sixth grade teacher at Bemidji Middle School. Thank you for hearing my testimony today, House committee members. I have taught middle and high school in Greater Minnesota for the last 22 years, and I come to you today as an MNSTA, Minnesota Science Teachers Association member, serving as the state Earth Science Representative and coordinator of a program called ESTEP, Earth Science Teacher Education Project. I come to you to ask for funding of up to 1,150 Minnesota sixth grade and high school science teachers over 3 years as they learn the content and pedagogy, the skills and strategies needed to teach earth science effectively. Minnesota teachers, especially in Greater Minnesota, are in need of targeted high quality professional development in the area of earth and space science. And in fact, we have now filled tentatively three workshops for this summer already. We have two workshops tentatively scheduled for the Metro and one in Bemidji. I can testify that access to high quality professional development and additional licensure preparation for teachers in Greater Minnesota is hard to come by. Teachers and districts want this training and they are willing to share the cost to attend. This funding would support direct workshop expenses while districts and in many cases individual teachers will fund the remainder of the expenses such as travel, food, and lodging. We fully support the 2019 Minnesota Science Standards and recognize that they were built on best practices and current research. We also believe that all Minnesota students deserve to have teachers that are well-trained. When the 2009 Minnesota Science Standards were released, professional development for teachers in the area of chemistry and physics for additional licensure was acquired through programs funded through the Minnesota Department of Ed. And as a result, 170 Minnesota teachers, many teaching in Greater Minnesota, earned additional licensure in these areas and teacher shortages were significantly reduced. We will take it a step further, offering 3 years of workshops and cohorts in regions all over the state so that Greater Minnesota teachers have equal access. And districts will have the opportunity for their licensed science teachers to obtain additional licensure in earth and space, which is a big concern for rural districts. Many districts are already transitioning to the new standards, so the need for this program is now. We also have support from industry leaders and other organizations in the state to further earth science education. We have the support of industry leaders like the Aggregate and Ready Mix of Minnesota Group, as well as the Minnesota Groundwater Association. These affidavits are in your packet. Perhaps the most compelling support, though, comes from former students who wrote personal testimonies advocating for high-quality earth and space science education for all Minnesota students. The impact of their K-12 earth and space science coursework that was facilitated by a highly trained science educator is evidence in their passionate pleas in support of this program and of earth science courses for all students in Minnesota. Please consider this modest request for funding for a true community-based approach to continue the rich tradition of ongoing professional development for our teachers and for future generation of student scientists. Thank you so much for your time and consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Questions from members? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bliss, for bringing the bill forward. I guess the question, Mr. Chair, might be for Mr. Strom. This is written to spend money from the general fund. It appears to be a one-time expenditure. It might make sense if indeed this is a provision we're going to put forward that we consider taking some of the federal money that might be available as one time and using that instead. Has that been considered? Maybe Representative Bliss can answer that as well.
Why don't we throw it to Representative Strom first, and then Representative Bliss can respond as well. Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, we're still awaiting some details for the third round of federal funds regarding the pandemic. It's not clear to me. We were told by the department on the second round of funding that ongoing issues prior to the pandemic couldn't be addressed with federal funds. There was a specific case we asked about there. I'm not sure if science education would, science teacher education as proposed in this bill would meet that same definition. I think it's likely to me it would, that that would be considered a non-pandemic related activity. It's less clear to me with the third round of federal funding whether those same rules will apply.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Bliss, any response to Representative Drazkowski's question?
Well, I think it makes sense if we're allowed to do it, if it's a one-time funding opportunity, but I'll certainly defer to Mr. Strom, who seems to be the expert in the area.
You've picked up on the habits of this committee well, Representative Bliss.
Not my
Representative
first
Drazkowski. Representative Drazkowski, any follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all. I just hope we can keep our eyes wide open, and if there's an opportunity to do the fiscally responsible thing here, we will. Thank you.
Thank you for that. I there are some challenges ahead for all of us as the federal government hasn't, I think, provided the level of guidance needed to better understand or best understand the appropriate uses of those funds. So stay tuned. Any other questions from members? Seeing none. Representative Bliss, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee, for hearing this bill. I think it's vitally important that we get our science teachers the continuing education they need. And I do want to thank Ms. Smith for taking the time out of her day and her dedication to our students. It's greatly appreciated. Thank you very much for testifying for us. And thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee.
Thank you, Representative Bliss. Thank you, Ms. Smith. And members, just to note that when the hearing was posted, the public was invited to testify and no one signed up to do so. With that, Representative Mueller renews her motion to lay House File 1464 over for further consideration and possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Next on our agenda is House File 965. Representative Youakim, would you like to make a motion to move House File 965 before the committee and to lay it over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill?
Yes, Chair Dabney, I will.
Thank you very much, Representative Youakim. Members of the committee and members of the public, we're looking to lay this bill over by 11:25. I think we're doing well on staying on time. Chair Edelson, welcome back to the Education Finance Committee. We miss you. Before you introduce your bill, I understand you have an author's amendment you'd like to offer. And I can move the A1 author's amendment to be before the committee. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair Daphne. The A1 amendment, Representative Erickson actually brought up a really good point in education policy when we heard this bill, I believe a week ago or 2 weeks ago, that we just wanted to make sure that it was explicit in statute and in language that a student attending a non-public school would also be offered special education services under this legislation. The interpretation was that it would happen, but we wanted to make it explicit and thank Representative Erickson for her catching that.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or discussion regarding the author's amendment? And Representative Edelson, is that the totality of the amendment?
Yes. Chair Dabney, that is the amendment.
All right. Thank you very much. With that, the chair has moved the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the A1 amendment to put the bill in the order that Representative Edelson prefers, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Representative Edelson, then, to your House File 965 as amended.
Thank you, Chair Daphne and members. Good to see you. Miss being on Education Finance. So this bill, 965, as amended, would convene IEP teams to determine what student needs are and the supports that a student needs and maybe has lost throughout the last year of the pandemic. It gives IEP teams some flexibility to determine what types of services would be most appropriate, allows the IEP team to decide how many additional services and supports would be best for the student, and it provides funding to the school districts to provide the recovery services using federal dollars. Now, we have just some estimations and projections in terms of what the state of Minnesota will be getting. But I mean, I've heard projections of upwards of $40 million of special education relief money. And so I think members have received in your packets a great deal of letters of support. This pandemic has been hard on many families and children, but especially those children that have disabilities. Back in December, I worked with some families that had children that were critically need kids, and they were just not getting education services at all due to a confusion with PCA services. So this has been a challenging year. So I want to make sure that members see those letters in the packet. Those personal stories are incredibly important. This bill seeks to support the students with disabilities and make sure that we do cover the learning losses that has happened over the last year, and we use those federal dollars to do so. So, Mr. Chair, at this time, I would like to go to my testifiers.
Thank you very much, Representative Edelson. I have two testifiers on the list, starting with Maren Holden, Legal Services Advocacy Project. Ms. Holden, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Chair Dabney and members. My name is Maren Holden, and I'm an attorney at Legal Aid, which includes the Minnesota Disability Law Center. Thank you so much for your time hearing this important bill, and thank you to Representative Edelson for your leadership on it. As you all know, COVID-19 has been extremely disruptive to schools and students, especially students who have disabilities. As Representative Edelson mentioned, we have just been hearing so many stories from families whose children have really, really struggled uniquely because of how their disability impacts them during the pandemic. And you'll find many of these stories in the materials for today, stories of a student who is multiple grades behind grade level before the pandemic and has difficulty focusing, intellectual disabilities and delayed gross fine motor and speech skills, who is currently receiving only 20 minutes of one-on-one support and can't follow along or complete tasks without constant adult supervision. A kindergarten student who missed out on occupational therapy, speech, developmentally adaptive PE, and as a result isn't ready to move on to first grade, so he will likely miss out on a year of transition services at the end of his public school career. One parent reports that their son has lost extremely valuable time. For some, the setback may simply be a loss of 14 weeks. For us, it sets us back a couple years. Despite just tremendous efforts from schools, teachers, and parents, students with disabilities, many haven't gotten what they needed over the past year, and some have regressed. House File 965 would help students who have disabilities make up for what they've missed by ensuring that IEP teams can collaborate to determine if a student has struggled due to pandemic disruptions, and if so, how to best provide services and supports to help the student make up lost ground. This is especially important for Minnesota's Black, Indigenous, and students of color who have disabilities, who have been disproportionately impacted by learning disruptions during the pandemic. The bill is a product of extensive collaboration with stakeholders, and we think this is a good approach. It provides recovery services part of the IEP process, which will be happening for these kids anyway, and ensures parent involvement, which is we think is important, as many parents are the ones who've been with their kids 24/7 for the past year. It's proactive and doesn't depend on families reaching out, as some families are more likely to seek out additional service for their children, but we don't want to leave any families behind or kids behind. Finally, it allows districts and IEP teams to consider a range of additional services and would provide funding for them, but prioritizing the use of available federal funds. Thank you so much, Representative Edelson, for your leadership on this bill, and thanks to the committee for hearing it. We really hope that you'll advance this important legislation. And I'll be available for questions if members have them.
Thank you, Ms. Holden. Next and last on my list is Dika Farah, a parent. Ms. Farah, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Daphne and committee members. My name is Deca Farah, and I live in Eagan, Minnesota. I'm a parent of two small children, ages 7 and 4, one of whom is autistic. He has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, and language impairment. Before COVID, my son, the 7-year-old, was learning to say words like Eagan for where he lived, his name, and his age. He was learning how to draw vertical lines while sitting for 10 minutes. That was huge for him. It may seem like a very small and easy thing, but unlike a neurotypical child, let me tell you, my son worked hard for countless days with multiple therapists to be able to do that. These are just some of the things he was doing before COVID and distant learning. At first, we tried distant learning. We scheduled Zoom sessions in hopes we would continue his progression. But despite our best efforts, Haroon struggled with distant learning. Sitting still was hard for him. Sitting still in front of a computer was impossible. He became frustrated, and I became demoralized. My son needs and thrives with physical proximity and one-on-one with teachers and staff to learn. My son has a lot of trouble staying focused and working independently due to his multiple disabilities. Distant learning has not been a good fit for my child. He has regressed in this aspect. All of the language and social skills we worked so hard to build over the years almost vanished within months. In order to make up for the ground we lost, I'll have to reach out to the school, ask for Haroon to be reassessed to figure out how much he has regressed during this pandemic. It is important to have the entire team of adults make the time to sit down to talk about what is best for the child. We need the teachers at the table, and we need the parents too, since they have been working most closely with their children since the pandemic began. But not every parent can do this. This is an equity issue. Some children will receive these services simply because their parents have the time, resources, and knowledge to advocate for them, and others will not. If we rely on families to reach out to schools, only the families with the most access and the most resources will do so, leaving families without the access even further behind. I'm asking for your support for House File 965 for recovery education. Making up for what has been lost during this past year would be impossible, but this bill would provide a start by making sure that families like mine have a place to start. Thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Ms. Farah, thank you for that. Questions from members? Representative Youakim. Representative Youakim, you're muted.
Well, that doesn't help. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just reading the fiscal note. I noticed there was an appropriation at the end, and I just wanted to make sure I understood. In the fiscal note, they said there's a local impact possibly with providing some of these services. Is that what the appropriation is meant to kind of help soften that blow?
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is the fiscal note will be revised over the next few days. We have been working with fiscal staff and MDE, specifically with MDE, to ensure that. Ms. Holden, do you want to have maybe explain some of your conversations, alert members?
Ms. Holden?
Thank you, Chair Daphne, and thank you, Representative Youakim, for the question. The appropriation was intended to ensure that that districts who are providing services under this bill are receiving full reimbursement rather than the cross-subsidy gap. And so we are working with MDE to ensure that that occurs. As far as the local impact, I'm still in conversations with MDE about that, but as you can see in the appropriation language and the first engrossment, the appropriation is intended to allow schools to use that to compensate staff for their time performing the activities under the act. And so we hope that that will alleviate any of the local impact, and would expect that more of this comes out of appropriations from the state, which we expect to be canceled by federal funds, to make sure that districts are reimbursed 100% for the special education and recovery services that they provide under this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Holden. Representative Youakim?
Mr. Chair, thank you. That's what I thought, but I just wanted to check.
All right. Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a similar question. I didn't see the fiscal note to begin with, but just started to dig into it. But I'm struggling to understand where the fiscal impact is of the bill. Representative Edelson, I mean, I'm not an in-school K through 12 person, but can you tell us what, I mean, these IEP teams, are they all government employees to begin with? They're salaried people?
Representative Edelson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, but there will be additional work that will need to happen, partnerships with community providers as well. And so there is a great deal of learning loss that happened over this last year and a great deal of learning loss that needs to be made up. So those partnerships will cost districts money, and we want to make sure that in doing so that those federal dollars that we will be getting an allocation on once they're certified, that those are going to be used to help those students specifically with that learning loss. So that the partnerships will be a pretty large, substantial cost, I imagine.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Edelson, are these partnerships new entities introduced by the bill? Or, I mean, again, these are IEP teams that are there. These are functioning teams that are working on behalf of these students year-round, I understand. Or is that something new in the bill, these partnership teams you talked about?
Representative Edelson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, what's happened over the last year is that some students that have disabilities have received hardly the delivery and the model of which they have received services has not been great. So, it will actually require, districts are going to need help with the recovery of what, for instance, say I worked with children this winter who had a PCA that were at home. Those children usually receive numerous services throughout the day when they're in person. They received little to none, and it's not necessarily district's fault because we're in a pandemic, but received little to no services during that time. So as our testifier would mention, maybe speech therapy, physical therapy, all of those things that one district is just not going to be able to make up for in 1 year will have to be outsourced as well. But that will be decided by the IEP team. And that's what we received these federal funds for, is this specifically to make sure. And I think the federal government knows that some students have truly been left behind in this pandemic, and no more so than kids with disabilities.
Representative Drazkowski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Edelson. I still don't see in the bill where the new incurrence of liability to the school district occurs. But certainly, Representative Edelson, the damage that Governor Walz's education theft has caused to the kids in our state extends to these kids as well, all kids in our schools. But I still fail to understand where the new costs are. These are professionals that are being paid. I don't know that any of them have not been paid throughout the pandemic and will likely be paid going forward. But maybe what you're talking about is there's actual they're going to be contracting out for additional work with people that are outside of the IEP teams. Is that what we're talking about? And so where is that in the bill, Mr. Chairman, or Representative Edelson?
Ms. Holden, can you be of any help to Representative Drazkowski here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Drazkowski. I think the biggest source of needed additional funding for this is that there will simply need to be more services, because children who have really struggled, and for example, as Ms. Farah explained, if a child was making good progress by getting regular services and then haven't been able to maintain that level of skill development, not only will that child need an opportunity to rebuild those skills, but for some children with disabilities, even the act of going to school and getting into the routines of being in school in a big environment with many peers is something that they have to work hard on daily to stay regulated in order to do that. And so we anticipate, and I think districts anticipate this too, that there will just need to be simply more services. But the other piece that I think the additional need for funding comes from is that Our aim here is to ensure that there isn't a cross-subsidy gap on the additional services that districts supply, so that there's no so that districts have everything that they need to be able to provide students what they need to get caught up. And we think that's the intention of the federal bill too. To the question about partnerships with community partners, there is a line in the language at the end of can find it quickly, subdivision 2, I believe, that notes that, and this is at line 2.25, that states that the IEP team may determine that providers, in addition to school district or charter school staff, are most appropriate to provide the services and supports described in paragraph A. That's in there because we anticipate that there may be situations where a school district has many kids who've missed months of speech therapy, and they only have one speech therapist, and the speech therapist is taking the summer off. And so, you know, in that unique situation for this limited time period, it may make most sense for that district or those IEP teams to decide, look, we'll find a local community speech therapy provider who can come in and provide this burst of services that these students need. Or there may be students for whom doing additional academic work, and you'll see this in the letters, lots of families talking about the need for additional tutoring, but a kid who's going to school 6 hours a day, for whom that's really challenging, can't do that at the end of the day, and so they need it on the weekends. And if the school district knows of a community partner that has great tutoring programs on the weekends, the district or the IEP team may decide to do that. And that's not necessarily the driving force of needing additional funding. That's just a flexibility to give IEP teams, the group of adults closest to the kid, the chance to make decisions about how to help this kid in particular make up what they've missed.
Representative Drozdowski, does that answer your question?
I think so, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the discussion. My first time, Mr. Chair, on the Education Committee, and mm-hmm. I commented on mm-hmm. this bill last time. Maybe it's just the culture of the committee and the culture of education spending in Minnesota to put a blank appropriation on the end of bills. And Mr. Chair, the other committees don't often operate this way. There's actually identified expenses that are identified and quantified. And I can see how some of these are somewhat identified, find the need for referral. I read that word in 2.25, and I thank you, Ms. Holden, for that. But the normal process of quantifying and identifying and the fiscal responsibility here, Mr. Chair, seems to be pretty loosey-goosey. But I'll leave it at that. Thank you, Representative Edelson and Ms. Holden, for the discussion.
Well, Representative Drozdowski, it is common across committees in this body to hear bills where the fiscal impact is still being developed. We simply don't have a timeline process that allows us to wait until every last I is dotted and T's crossed before we consider it a concept. And so we have heard this bill while they continue to work on the fiscal note, just as committees across the legislature hear bills where the fiscal note is being considered. We don't pass bills until we have a full fiscal note. Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add to Representative Drozdowski, welcome to the complicated funding stream of education. And it's complicated because kids are complicated. Kids are complicated, and we need to meet them where they're at if we're going to have them meet their full potential. And I want to thank Representative Edelson for bringing this bill forward and seeing a need. COVID hit everyone differently. This pandemic was global. It's once in 100 years. Folks struggled in the beginning, but I want you to know that districts across our states worked really, really hard to provide services for our students in the best way that they could. I know personally I have 6 teachers in our family. My husband's one of them. He taught starting this September in person with the Level 4 program, making sure students got on-site services. So districts did what they could, but they need help catching kids back up, because all kids were affected differently, just like our economy. We're not getting a V-shaped recovery like you would in a regular downturn. It's a K-shape. Some people are still being left behind. I want to thank you for still digging into this. I'm sure it's still a work in progress, especially trying to figure out the complicated funding streams that are usually really braided together to try to serve the students we're talking about. So thank you.
Representative Drozdowski, briefly, please.
Thank you. Briefly, Mr. Chair. And Representative Youakim, thank you for that comment. Well, Representative Joachim, a lot of areas are complicated. Property taxes, as you know, is complicated as well. And we don't put a lot of blank appropriations on the end of bills. And Mr. Chair, you're right. Unfortunately, we have seen it's not until at times the bill gets to the House floor before the full details are fleshed out. And I look forward to that with this bill and the rest of them that come before us. But Mr. Chair, fiscal responsibility is complicated as well, and we need to endeavor to do that. And it's my hope that we can do that with this bill and the rest of the education bill as well. So with that, thank you.
Agreed on that goal, Representative Drazkowski. Thank you. Representative Edelson, do you have any closing remarks?
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the discussion here, being proactive to make sure that we deal with the learning loss that's happened over this last year is incredibly important. Representative Drazkowski, I appreciate your questions. There is complexity, especially to kids with special needs and what needs to happen. I would be happy. I have two children that have special needs to talk with you just of what the IEP teams, what it looks like and trying to understand that complicated process more as well, because this is a bipartisan effort to make sure that we do what's right here. And so I hope members from the Republican Party will also sign on to this. I know I just sent my friend, Representative Daniels, an email asking him to sign on. He's been such a champion for people with disabilities as well, and especially students. So just ask members for their support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. And with that, Representative Joachim renews her motion to lay over House File 965 as amended for possible inclusion in a future omnibus. Representative Edelson, don't leave. Chair Richardson, would you like to make a motion to move House File 1644 before the committee and to lay it over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus?
Yes, Mr. Chair, so moved.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. Members of the committee and members of the public, we're looking to lay this over by 11:45 this morning. Representative Edelson, glad you didn't go anywhere. Before you introduce your bill, I understand that you have an author's amendment that you'd like to offer. I'll move the A6 amendment to be before the committee. Representative Edelson, would you please describe the A6 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And before I do that, I just wanted to offer an oral amendment to the A6, which right. would be, Mr. Chair, do I need approval? Mm-hmm.
Please describe your oral amendment, Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The oral amendment would be I would point members to the A6 of lines 2.23 to 2.26. This is a discussion about simultaneous learning. And so members understand what simultaneous learning is. It is, I don't know if anybody watched the 60 Minutes episode that happened last Sunday, but it's on the screen. There was on the screen you're watching for 60 Minutes, the teacher is in a classroom with kids in the classroom, but also kids on a screen. And he called the kids in the room, the roomies, and kids on the screen, the zoomies. And so simultaneous teaching is when a teacher is in that classroom trying to teach to both. Now, what we have heard from conversations with superintendents in smaller districts, from superintendents right here in the urban core and from teachers on a survey that this is, and also from students, that this has not been a great methodology of teaching over this last year. It puts teachers in a bad place of trying to feel conflicted while trying to teach two people or two different groups at one time. And it's hard because the student doesn't necessarily feel engaged. So at this time, with this bill and all the stakeholders, we will be striking this from the record.
All right, Representative Edelson incorporates the oral amendment deleting lines 2.23 to 2.26 to the A6 amendment. Any discussion? Representative Kreisha.
No, I'm fine. We got heads up on this oral ahead of time, so we're good.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Any further discussion to the A6 amendment with the oral incorporation? Seeing none. All in favor of the Daphne motion on the A6 author's amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 All right. All those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. Thank you, members. Representative Edelson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 1644, as amended, provides districts with an option to offer distance learning. What stakeholders have been engaging in conversations, the superintendents at Minnesota Rural Schools, the School Board Association, AMSD, on the need for having that ability to offer distance learning again for the 2021-2022 school year specifically. And there has been negotiations. We have several agreements that are within this bill. There are still a few things that we need to kind of iron out, but this would allow districts to offer distance learning without applying for online accreditation. We have so many districts, and right now MDE currently has 25 schools, that independent school districts, that they've approved online licensure for. There's 25 that are in the works right now. And I know that this is, well, from the last bill, you can tell distance learning hasn't worked for everybody, but it in fact has worked well for many students. And what this bill does is it appoints a task force that will really look in and dive in and try to figure out what can districts keep that worked and what doesn't work, and that we get rid of that so that there's a report to the legislature that would happen. And at this point, it also offers an instructional, what we call seat time. It offers a little bit more flexibility on that. Discussions are still happening with this, but I would at this point like to move to my testifiers and be happy to take member questions.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. I've got two testifiers on my list, starting with Superintendent Mirapuri Reed from the Hopkins Public Schools. Superintendent, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Rhoda Mirapuri Reed. I'm the superintendent of Hopkins Public Schools, and I just want to thank all of you legislators for your leadership during this challenging time, and also thank Representative Edelson for offering the amendment to House File 1644 that allows districts the authority to have a distance learning program for the 21-22 school year. And I fully support this amendment. So I'll just begin by offering a bit of context about my district. Hopkins serves approximately 7,000 students across seven cities and beyond. Like all districts, of course, we've had a year to remember. When COVID crashed into the universe in March of 2020, we took an immediate crash course, I would say, in facilitating distance learning for preschool through grade 12 and also transition plus. And over the course of this school year, we've gotten a lot better at it. And some of our parents and student scholars would like to continue distance learning for next year. So in this past September, we launched hybrid learning for our K-6 scholars and kept our 7-12 scholars in full-time distance learning until very recently. We had several elementary pivots throughout the year, from hybrid to distance, back to hybrid to increased hybrid, and recently to full-time in-person. And then these pivots and all of the quarantining of individual classrooms has required us to seamlessly transition students back and forth between distance learning and in-person learning. So our students have become very accustomed to learning in a distance learning environment. Also, at the secondary level, we had our 7-12 scholars in distance learning from the start of the school year until just very recently. They began attending school 2 days a week, and this week is their first time in school 4 days a week. So the interesting thing is that even though all families have been provided the option to return to in-person learning full-time, all of our schools still have families continuing to select full-time distance learning for their scholar. The percentage of families continuing to opt into distance learning is about 30% district-wide, with each of our secondary schools serving between 23 and 37% of distance learners. Even more interesting is we've been polling our families recently to find out what they would like their schooling next year to look like for their scholars. And we have more than 200 junior high families who said that they are somewhat or very interested in distance learning for next year. And although we're still collecting responses from our high school families, we do anticipate the numbers to be higher than that. And just like Representative Edelson said, yes, there are some students who distance learning is not for them. They really do need that in-person experience. This is very true. And also, we have scholars who have thrived in distance learning. These include scholars who are socially anxious, scholars who are strong independent learners, adolescents who are engaged in full-time jobs, yes, we have them, or part-time jobs outside of school, or older students who are caretakers for younger siblings, or elderly or disabled adults in the home. Our scholars have shared with us that they enjoyed the flexibility of distance learning, where they gained a true sense of independence, college preparedness, increased decision-making abilities, agency, self-directedness, and also the flexibility with distance learning created opportunities for many of our high school scholars to take advantage of internships and other career preparation experiences. One really amazing point, legislators, that we recently uncovered is that our students of color, in particular, are Hispanic and Latinx, Black and African American, and students of two or more races, raised their GPAs substantially while in distance learning. They even made larger gains in their GPAs than in previous years, and also when compared to their white peers. So just to conclude, I know our time is short. There are a number of reasons districts need to be allowed to offer a distance learning program for next year. Not only do we all have students, so across the state, who have thrived in distance learning, but we have a responsibility to respond to what our families are desiring and requesting. At the district level, we are preparing for multiple scenarios because we don't know what the future holds. We don't know if we'll still be in a pandemic in September. We don't know if all parents, children, and youth will be vaccinated with no expected date for all children to be vaccinated. We have families who will continue to have health concerns and will be weary of sending their children to school. And even in the rare case that everyone is fully vaccinated, we're confident that a subset of our families will seek something other than full-time in-person learning, and they will make their own determinations for what they want schooling to be like, and we would like the flexibility to meet their expectations. If we don't have that flexibility to meet families' varied expectations, we predict that we will experience another statewide enrollment decline next year. We predict that families will opt into accredited online programming. They might choose to homeschool at higher rates or choose a form of microschooling that they feel meets their needs. And so districts do need to be able to respond to their constituents, and unless the legislature takes action to allow this flexibility, we will not be able to. Families and school districts greatly appreciate your support of distance learning programming for next year. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Superintendent. Next on my list is Arjun Maheshwari, a senior at Edison High School. Arjun, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair and fellow members of the Ed Finance Committee. My name is Arjun Maheshwari, and I'm a senior at Edina High School. As the senior grade lead on the Edina Student Senate, I've been a student liaison between the PTO and administration, and so I'm here to share the student perspective on distance learning. Edina's had a hybrid option for most of the year, but many of my friends and I have been virtual the entire year. There are indeed many groups of students for whom distance learning does not work, but I'm here to share how my friends and I and my peers and I have seen many benefits from doing school online. First of all, it allows for much greater flexibility at times when extracurriculars or jobs, college apps, family obligations, et cetera, become particularly burdensome or intense. And for those students, there have definitely been increases in GPAs across the school. Secondly, for many kids struggling with their mental health issues, having the option to be online is a good respite from the social stressors of in-person school, especially those who are encountering like a lot of bullying, for example. Finally, on a macro level, as per Edina school data, grades have actually had an increase, and every single AP teacher at our school agrees that students feel prepared for their AP tests next month. The data from Edina is clear that for independent learners and those with other obligations, distance learning is very effective, even if it's not effective for everyone. On that note, the most important section of this bill, in my opinion, lies in Section 3. Of course, virtual learning is not for everyone, but the instructional model working group would prove instrumental in directing long-term education policy. Thus far, all the discussion around this issue has been from individual testimony, but the working group would change that, allowing the state to make evidence-based policy on statewide statistics. Considering that the outlook for vaccine distribution among teens and younger kids is still uncertain, it's important to keep online school an option for those who feel unsafe going back or who have actually thrived in a virtual environment. Distance learning isn't for everyone, but it has allowed many students to thrive. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Members, questions? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a question for the Hopkins Superintendent.
Go right ahead, state your question.
So, Superintendent, how did you keep track of instructional hours during all your different models during the school closure and then in the fall when you maybe changed a bit?
Superintendent?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your question, Representative Erickson. So our principals meet weekly on Fridays. In fact, every week throughout this entire school year, our elementary principals meet on Friday afternoons and our secondary principals meet. And during this time, as cabinet leaders, we review the instructional hours that that teachers have been logging this entire school year. And so we look at the number of instructional minutes for synchronous learning as well as asynchronous learning. And we also count, we've been asking students to share with us how much time they're spending on assignments during class time and how much time they're spending on assignments outside of class time. So we have a number of ways that we're tracking not just instructional hours, but also the amount of time that scholars are spending completing their schoolwork.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Superintendent, did you have to submit any of that to MDE so that they have an idea statewide how instructional hours were kept track of, since it is one of our laws?
Superintendent.
Well, it's a good question. It's a little bit more technical than what I'm familiar with. So I know that we have to report to MDE what safe learning plan we are currently in. I imagine we do have to report our instructional hours. I just don't know who does that and when it's done, but I can get back to you on that. I know that we're responsible for reporting those hours every year. I just don't know sort of what month during the school year it occurs.
Thank you, Superintendent. Representative Erickson, any further questions?
Well, is MDE on our Zoom at all? Do we know?
No, but we can ask. Is there anyone here from MDE? From
the department? Good. Now we can find out. Thank you.
I believe the answer is no.
Chair, Ms. Morris is on.
No, Ms. Morris is here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Ms. Morris, can you help answer Representative Erickson's question, please? My apologies.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Shayna Morrison. I'm the Assistant Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. And I apologize to disappoint, but I believe I'm in the same boat as the superintendent in that I know that there's some reporting that happens. I'm just not sure when that detail is reported to us. I do know that districts are keeping up to date the learning model that their students are in from a broad perspective in terms of what they're offering to students, but we don't necessarily have individual student level data that's reported live, if you will. And so, but we're happy to check on that in terms of when we receive instructional hour information.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Morris. Thank you. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Edelson. And thank you, Dr. Mary Prier-Reed, for being here today. Nice to see you again. Thank you for providing great education in the Hopkins schools and being able to pivot and be flexible. And you're right, some of the programs you guys have started have flourished and have done better under distance learning in some cases and have better pod models, in-person learning that you might want to pursue, especially around the time, I know the flexibility for seat time and hours could be really helpful. I just had a few quick questions, maybe for the author. I'm a little concerned about lines 3.23 to 3.25. on the underlying bill regarding schools not being considered online providers as per other statutes. Is that just to kind of say if they're running their own program as a flexible program and not a full, complete online program, they don't have to be considered an online provider? Because if they're allowing students to be solely online, is it just because they're doing it for their own kids and not for other kids? Is that why?
Representative Edelson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, what we're doing is giving a one-year extension. So what this does is says that they don't have to become apply for the online accreditation, which is typically we require to be an online school. So we're waiving that for this year. So that's why that is. This bill actually would, though, allow, which is really critical that we, you know, the need to pass this is districts that want to provide a distance learning, say they have children that are open enrolled into the school, they would be able to provide an online option, but it wouldn't be to open enrolled students. And so it kind of leaves this big disparity. And so we really, as a legislature, really have to think about what districts are going to be facing if this does not pass. And if they do not have online accreditation. So thank you, Representative Joachim, for asking that question.
Representative Joachim?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be quick. Also, but the portion that is basically starting to add competency-based education is for 2021 to 2022 going forward. Is that accurate? That's that flexible school year?
Representative Edelson?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, it would be 2021 to 2022, just that 1 year is extended.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Joachim.
I'm talking more towards the flexible learning schedule. It says 2022 forward, not just just for this next year. So the flexible learning part continues on.
Representative Edelson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, are you talking about the hours of instruction?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yes. Then that is that would continue on.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Joachim? Yes, please.
Thank you. And we can talk about this offline. I have a little concern about the removal of MDE for some of that process and oversight. And then I have to apologize. I would have reached out. I just read the A6 last night, and we can talk about this online, but I wanted to put it on record. The A6, the 1.10 to 1.12, I worked this summer with a teacher that was concerned. He had checked the rigor on some of the online academies, especially when it came around teaching language. And right now, districts have the ability, if a student wants to apply for an online course, to be able to say, this isn't rigorous enough, we won't accept it as a credit, and you remove that in this section. So that is a little concerning to me, too, but we can talk about that offline.
Thank you very much, Representative Joachim. Other members with questions. Representative Sandstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make this brief. I just wanted to thank the author for her oral amendment today. As an educator and as a individual who works with 22 to 23 different school districts of teacher groups and paras, this past fall we had some very, very intense conversation around educators that were teaching simultaneously and how problematic it was just as an educator, but also like how they were struggling with the effectiveness of delivering education to their students. I know that, again, one size doesn't fit all for every school district, but my school district, I have to say, I really applauded my elementary school. I'm in a K-2 building. They had teachers that were dedicated as distance learning teachers, and that worked beautifully, but it allowed those educators, those teachers, to have that very connected relationship with their students instead of trying to bounce between those that are in the classroom and those that are at home. And it was just far more effective. So I really appreciate that oral amendment. I know that that was probably not an easy thing, but in my professional opinion as a teacher, I really think it was the right thing to do for our students and for the profession. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sandstein. Any other further questions from members? Seeing none, members and members of the public, As usual, the bill was posted, we provided opportunities for public to testify and the method for doing that. No one signed up to participate in the public portion of this hearing. With that, Representative Edelson, any closing remarks?
Thank you, Chair Daphne. And I just wanted to go back to what Representative Joachim actually said. We are having ongoing discussions about the hours of instruction, so happy to work with you with that. And in terms of the rigor, I don't know any school district that doesn't want to have a rigor, you know, or a great program for students. So, I mean, this is their school district. This is what, you know, they want to make sure that students are doing the best. And online schools didn't have to go through that transition from full school to in-person during a pandemic. So I'm sure they can be critical about what went through the last year. But I ask for member support on this. This is an important bill for all of us, for our teachers, for our students. It hasn't worked for everybody, but it really has worked for some kids. It's just so important. I do hope it's bipartisan in the Senate. I hope to make it bipartisan in the weeks ahead. So Republican members on this committee, be looking for an email from me very soon. Thank you so much. And I hope it gets in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. With that, Chair Richardson renews her motion to lay over House File 1644 as amended for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Thank you very much. Next, House File 2357. Representative Joachim, would you like to make a motion to move House File 2357 to be before the committee to lay it over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do.
Thank you very much. Members of the committee and members of the public, we're looking to lay this bill over by noon. Representative Joachim, please proceed with introducing your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I can talk fast. Over the last few months, members on this committee have heard discussions about the special ed cross subsidy and the effects it has on the budgets of school districts across the state. But this conversation did not start this year or last year or the year before that. It has been going on for decades. The costs for cross subsidies have ballooned over time. Last year, Education Finance Working Group was put together to discuss all things school finance. They spent a great deal of time digging into special education, both cost drivers and areas where the state is underfunding these important services for students. This bill attempts to address a few of the key concerns raised by that working group. The bill builds on Governor Walz's recommendations to ensure school districts aren't shouldering a greater share of special education costs by increasing the percentage of cross-subsidy reduction aid and the state reimbursements. It maximizes drawing down federal funding from MA services by making it clear that school districts and charters must bill for eligible services. It modifies tuition billing to close the gap between resident school districts and charters. The MDE has data that shows the cost differentials between disability categories and districts have been very odd, with districts picking up at least 80%, sometimes more, of the reimbursed costs. Finally, there are two provisions related to district costs associated with students served as intermediates or core operatives. These provisions allow districts to levy for some of their costs related to the services their students receive. So to stay on time, I only have one testifier, Marcy Dow, the Assistant Superintendent for Specialized Services and a member of the Education Finance Working Group.
Thank you very much, Representative Joachim. Ms. Dowd, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Marcy Dowd, and I am the Assistant Superintendent of Specialized Services for St. Paul Public Schools. I am also a member of MDE School Finance Working Group, and I had the pleasure of working with Paul Farron and Tom Melcher in a subgroup which developed the special education recommendations. As you all know, special education has many state and federal mandates to support our students in special education. Districts also receive both state and federal funds to offset special education expenditures. The revenue that districts receive does not fully cover the cost of special education, resulting in districts using general education revenue to backfill unfunded mandates. We call this the special education cross subsidy, or the unreimbursed portion of special education. The special education cross subsidy has grown from 8% of the formula to 12% over the past 15 years and is projected to grow 15% or more over the next 10 years. So what does this mean in numbers per ADM, or average daily membership? The cross subsidy is projected to grow an average of 843 per ADM in fiscal year 23 with the current law. For St. Paul Public Schools, the cross subsidy for fiscal year 19 was $41 million. So in essence, $41 million of general education revenue was used to support the unreimbursed portion of special education. The number one goal of the task force was to reduce the cross subsidy, which is included in this bill. Also included in the task force recommendation and in this bill is reforming tuition billing for charter schools and maximizing medical assistant reimbursement. I want to thank Representative Joachim for this bill and her other bill to require DHS to access federal revenue for mental health services for special education. Other states like Wisconsin can already bill for these services. This bill strengthens the language in current law that requires all schools and charter schools to bill for MA eligible services. MA eligible billing provides revenue to help offset the cross subsidy I was just talking about. The bill also addresses the range in charges across disability areas for tuition billing. So tuition billing occurs when a student in special education open enrolls in a district that is not the resident district or where they live. The unreimbursed portion of special education is billed back to the resident district. And the billing rates align to the serving district's expenditures. In the most recent MDE comparison of average special education costs by disability, charter school rates for speech language services on average were 207% greater than a traditional district's rate and 211% greater for deaf and hard of hearing. Across the board, the rates for charter schools average 128% greater than traditional districts, and resident districts are billed for these services, yet no revenue is provided to offset these bills. Lastly, not all districts are members of intermediates or cooperatives, and or some districts who are members are member of one but not multiple intermediates. For St. Paul Public Schools, we are not a member of an intermediate school district or cooperative because we of our size and our ability to provide the continuum of services for students in special education. However, we, like other districts, have resident students who open enroll in another district, and then that district, or possibly the county, places the student in an intermediate, cooperative, or a treatment program. Those programs have access fees. The ability to levy for access fees, which is not part of the special education formula, would reduce the cross subsidy that I shared or talked about earlier. So I want to thank you for allowing me to testify in support of House File 2357.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dowd. Questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Joachim, would you like to add any final comments?
I just want to say thank you, and if folks have questions, let me or the stakeholders know why this bill will not completely erase the special education cross subsidy. It will definitely help to mitigate it. I would appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Joachim, and members of the public. Again, when this hearing was posted, the public was provided with instructions on how to sign up to testify during the public portion of the bill hearing, and we received no requests from the public to testify. Members, Representative Joachim, thank you. With that, we are adjourned.